This evening, we're going to hear several perspectives on the genocide in Darfur, Sudan. We'll hear from locals who rallied in Pioneer Courthouse Square last weekend and from a Darfurian who is advocating international intervention. And we'll hear from our own Africa on Fire contributors, Michael Chowell and Karifa Karoma. We start with the president of the American Jewish World Service and human rights advocate Ruth Messenger. In the last year, Messenger has traveled to Darfur and nearby Chad to visit refugee camps and see firsthand the toll of widespread violence there. Messenger is working to build a broad coalition to intervene, emphasizing what should be an international rejection of genocide, whether it's the Jews during the Holocaust or now the Sudanese in Darfur. We begin with the reasons she's advocating for the people of Sudan.
When people ask me why Darfur, why is this the issue that you've chosen to speak up and speak out, to educate and to act, there are several reasons. The first one is that we actually know what is happening. Well, that doesn't mean that every American knows what's happening, and it doesn't mean that everyone in this room knows what's happening. This is a subject very, very poorly covered in our media for lots of reasons that we were just speculating about at lunch. We are indebted to a limited number of people who brought the information to public awareness, and I will cite several times in my remarks Nick Kristof, who is an op-ed columnist for the New York Times, and I cite him wherever I talk about Darfur, not just today because his parents are in the audience, but because we really do know what's going on. I want to tell you two things about the former administration. Bill Clinton says now, when asked, that the biggest disappointment of his big personal biggest disappointment about his 8 years in office was that he failed to respond to the genocide in Rwanda in a timely basis. That's an important comment to have, for all of us to have and reflect on as we try to move forward. On the other hand, I want to tell you that Bill Clinton went to Kigali in Rwanda on the fifth anniversary of the genocide in April of 1999 and made a speech of formal apology to the people of Rwanda. But the essence of his speech is, if we had only known, we would have acted. But we did know. And we know now, and we have much less excuse now. The only excuse that the world could possibly posit about our failure to respond in April of 1994 was that it all happened so fast, that in Rwanda close to a million Tutsis and moderate Hutus were killed in the space of 90 days, 100 days, in a real genocide. But as one of my colleagues has said, Darfur is Rwanda in slow motion. So, frankly, much less excuse not to respond. This genocide started exactly 3 years ago, in February 2003. And it continues at a pace at which death may be slow, but the destruction of people's lives and livelihoods and the crises that have been created for the survivors are at least as horrible as those in any genocide. The government in Sudan is run by a man named Omar al-Bashir, who is, in my judgment, seized power about 17 years ago, and is an evil force in the world. And he continued an ongoing civil war between North Sudan, which is Muslim, and South Sudan, which is Christian and animist. And that civil war, depending on who you interview, has either gone on since the British left Sudan in 1956, or at least for the last 20 years. Over the last 5 years, the Bush administration actually intervened and created a fragile peace agreement between North and South Sudan. And a condition of that peace agreement was that John Garang, the leader of South Sudan, would become a vice president in the new government of national unity, so-called. Dr. Garang was killed in a helicopter accident almost immediately after this agreement. There is officially a coalition government I think many people in the world would question if it's really giving any weight or strength to the voice of South Sudan. But whatever happened between North and South to get this peace agreement left Darfur out. And Darfur is a portion of the country of Sudan, which is particularly poor, which going back endlessly in colonial history has always felt neglected in the negotiations and wanted its own peace, peace of the action. So there were some rebels in Darfur who stirred the pot by attacking an army garrison 3 years ago. And that became the incident that the government used. It was a little teeny incident, but it became the incident that the government used to launch this attack on the people of Darfur and to mobilize the Janjaweed militia to extend the attack. So in July of 2004, I went to Darfur as a guest of one of the international relief agencies. I was in three different camps for what are called internally displaced persons, so-called because they're not refugees, because they're still living in their own country, even though they've been thrown out of their own communities. And then in this past year, in October of 2005, I went back. I went to Chad and not Darfur because nobody would take me to Darfur because it's not safe. And by the way, now it's not safe to go to Chad either. But Chad is the country to the west of Darfur. It shares a border. And about 300,000 of the more than 2 million people in Darfur who were displaced from their homes by this genocide, about 300,000 of them made it with their families across the border. So they are now in Chad, where the camps that they live in, which you'll see pictures of later, are legally, under international parlance, refugee camps, therefore being overseen by the United Nations, but where the circumstances are much the same, and by the way, right now getting much, much worse. What I want to say first, though, is that in both Darfur and Chad, in each country, I was in three different refugee camps with seven different translators, interviewing probably a total of 40 or 50 people, where we simply asked, could you tell us your story? And what's chilling about these stories, and I apologize for what's about to come, is not so much the story, although it's chilling. What's chilling is that everyone tells the same story. It's basically a story of a government-sponsored attack on their villages, of the attempts that were made, successful attempts, to force people from their homes, to destroy their livelihoods, and to terrify them into fleeing into the desert. So basically, this is what people tell you. First, the planes came and bombed my village. My uncle, my cousins, my brother was killed. I saw women being raped. No woman ever tells you she was raped, but people will talk about rape. And then they say the Janjaweed rode in, yelling ethnic slogans, brandishing swords. This gets pretty gruesome. Killing children, raping and branding women, slaughtering our farm animals, and stuffing the bodies of animals and children in the wells in order to poison the water supply. And so people tell you, then we fled, and they burned our village to the ground. The world estimate is that probably 200,000 people were killed by the direct violence in villages, and that more than 200,000 have died since as a consequence of wandering in the desert, making their way to camps where there's not adequate water, where there's not adequate access to clean water, and where there's not enough food. People now who were subsistence farmers in among the most arid land in the world, but managed to eke out a living, now totally dependent on you and me for any food they're going to get, with no future notion of ever being able to go back to their farms and having lost the livestock on which they depended. And this is, by the way, I'm happy to discuss this later, but this is, by the way, a direct part of the definition of genocide as adopted by the United Nations in 1948. And that, to me, was very revealing, because I guess I misassumed that a definition adopted in 1948 would essentially describe what we know happened under Hitler from 1938 to 1945, and so would mean that the world would only decide genocide if they saw these massive efforts with a targeted vision, you know, a specific calling out of names. All of the Jews, all of the gypsies, all of the homosexuals must die. That's not what it says. It says that any effort to disrupt a people, a population based solely on who they are, to kill some of their number, to displace them from their livelihoods, to destroy their natural cycle of family reproduction because of who they are, is a genocide. So back to the story, the generic story that I shared, please pay particular note to this sentence that starts almost everyone's story. First, the planes came. No posse, no militia, no group of angry people, no tribe has airplanes. The planes belong to the government of Sudan. And when people say bombed, it turns out that they don't mean bombs the way you and I understand them. These planes dropped anything that was large enough and heavy enough so it would destroy mud and straw homes and so it would kill the people it hit. Old car chassis, dead refrigerators, non-functioning generators and air conditioners, kegs full of nails, anything. The militia that people then refer to is a group of people. Janjaweed means, depending on whom you ask, evil men on horseback, or men on horseback, or devils on horseback. I've heard them all. It's a militia of people who were, and I guess to some extent still are, grazers. That is, their livelihood is to graze herds of camels in this same very arid land in Darfur that another group of people is looking to farm. So, of course, as happens all over the world, part of the story here and part of the conflict is over scarce resources, in this case, water. But the fundamental issue is that the government turned on a group of its own people in a Muslim against Muslim genocide, in which the difference is between the Arab-identified fundamentalists who are connected to the government and the African-identified Muslims who are farmers who, by the way, speak Arabic, just as in Rwanda they all look the same to a Westerner. But the farmers have very strong roots in their own tribal connections and identification, and they apparently, for reasons that we will probably never understand, pose such a severe threat or have become such a convenient scapegoat that this genocidal effort has been launched. So what's the situation today? The estimate is that more than 2 million people from Darfur have been displaced, that probably 3.5 million people moving up lack adequate food, that the camps where most people are living range in size between 15 and 100,000. When you see pictures of the camps, you will mostly be struck by how resilient people are, that by and large they put whatever's left of their family together, doing whatever they can, and try to find something to do all day. But there are no resources. There's not enough water. There's not enough food. There's a current and particularly imminent threat, because of United Nations budget cutbacks, of loss of people to do basic maintenance of the latrines. And that means that we're at growing risk of our first severe epidemic in the camps. We have avoided, miraculously, the world has avoided spread of cholera, dysentery, in the camps, which we thought would be happen immediately, but now that we are going to lose latrine maintenance, that's more likely. There's also a growing amount of political instability, not only in Sudan, but now in Chad, where people fled, where the one thing that was secure was that if you were in Chad, then the border of your camp was not dangerous. What was dangerous, to be blunt, was that you were living in Chad, which is the 173rd poorest country in the world out of 177. No resources whatsoever. And so it's a huge effort, again, by international groups to bring in some resources without totally destabilizing the situation for the people who live there. But anyway, Chad is now immediately the subject of a major meltdown. The first thing that happened starting a few weeks ago was that the Janjaweed, egged on by the Sudanese government, started coming across the border and doing the same attacks in the refugee camps in Chad that they've been doing in Sudan the whole time. Between and among people. What I would say very comfortably is that the colonial history of the world, but particularly in Africa, is directly responsible for a lot of the problems on that continent today. Many of these countries that are alleged to and described as having tribal differences have those differences because the people who live there didn't draw the borders of these countries. The borders of almost all of Africa, you read a book called The Taking of Africa, I hope, by Howard French, who was the Times Africa reporter. But the book is called The Taking of Africa or The Taking of a Continent, one or the other. But it's a really good book about just some aspects of the period of time when he was going to Africa, covering Africa. But it makes the point that there were ancient, powerful civilizations that the colonial powers destroyed, and that the colonial powers drew lines that were convenient to them because they connected the Red Sea to a river, because they allowed for the transport of goods, because various chunks of Africa were part of the spoils of war. So we created a lot of countries that have shown, not surprisingly, a difficulty in creating a national identity and coherence in the time since. Since I've tried to suggest here that I don't feel fully informed as to explain the ways in which a leader like al-Bashir can stir up this level of hatred, which was, I don't know whether that can be easily diffused. I don't know whether the only solution includes changing the government of Sudan, which I'm not advocating because I run a not-for-profit organization, but certainly is what some people think. The easier explanations for the differences between these two groups are also not easily resolvable. We don't have any way of getting more water into the growing parts of Africa that are becoming increasingly arid. So I don't want to say here, and I don't want to be misunderstood, that I think the solutions that bring peace in Darfur, that allow 2 million people to return to 2,000 villages that have been firebombed to the ground, are something that the world has much positive experience with. But I do know that right now a minimum of 500 people a day are dying in the camps. That if the latrine maintenance stops, that number could escalate from whatever that is, 15,000 a month to 80 or 90,000 a month. I guess I want to urge all of us to deal with complexity. It's hard to understand the roots of a genocide, what actually made Hitler or Pol Pot or the Hutus do what they did. There are a lot of people who will tell you about Rwanda that a lot of those original tensions are still present. But enough interventions happen after, unfortunately, much too much slaughter that right now those people are not killing each other. That's better than when they were killing each other. So I don't want, you know, I'm an expert on the stuff that I talked about when I first started speaking about how to help a rural village do better farming, or how to help support a community that's fighting the AIDS pandemic. how to undo every step of this and envision 2 million people going back to 2,000 burned-out villages and getting their villages and their livestock sufficiently restored so they can begin become subsistence farmers. I don't want to begin to tell you that I have that answer or that the world does. I do want to say that I think we have a moral obligation to stop a genocide. ما لا واحتجب ودع على غضب ليت هاجري يشرح السبب.
Time now for local African news and events. African cuisine will be served at a benefit for a local church on Saturday. Felix Awe will DJ the benefit at Immaculate Heart Catholic Church May 6. It will be held at 2926 North Williams Avenue in Portland. An African dinner from Central, West, and East Africa will be served from 6 to 8 p.m. for $25. Dance tickets are $10. For advanced sales, call Mr. Caleb at 503-704-0312.
A healthcare professional from Uganda will speak at an evening honoring women and girls this Sunday. Dr. Millie Kanyongo of the organization CARE will speak at the celebration of Mothers in the Global Village. The event will be held at the Oregon Museum of Science and Industry on Sunday, May 7, from 1 to 3:30 p.m. Tickets are 5 or 15 per family. Pre-registration is required. Visit worldoregon.org or call Teresa at 503-274-7488.
What are the best ways for agencies to provide services to immigrants, refugees, and minority communities? Tools for Diversity will be presented on Tuesday, May 9th from 8:30 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Portland YWCA, 1111 Southwest 10th Avenue in Portland. Working with African populations is to be addressed. Cost is $135. To register or for more information, visit tacs.org.
Learn more about how illegal debt cripples developing countries. Jubilee Oregon Network presents the first annual Jubilee Grassroots Conference May 19 and 20. It is at the First Unitarian Church, 1011 Southwest 12th Avenue in Portland. Conference fee is $35. Call 202-783-0214 or register at jubileeusa.org.
The Day of the African Child is routinely celebrated in Africa, but virtually unknown in the United States. This year, Portland celebrates that day. The community gathering honoring the African child, past, present, and future, will be held on June 17th from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the World Forestry Center in Washington Park. The address is 4033 Southwest Canyon Road in Portland. For information, call 503-228-1367 or visit worldforestry.org. Send your African-related events and news to us at africaonfire@yahoo.com. Among the visitors to Portland for the first-of-its-kind genocide conference was Mohamed Yahya. He's a Sudanese exile who runs a nonprofit organization focused on relief and development. It's called Demanga. Yahya was born in Darfur and says his village was destroyed by genocidal violence in the mid-1990s. Africa on Fire contributors Karifa Karoma of Sierra Leone and Michael Chowell of Southern Sudan had a chance to ask Mr. Yahya some questions about Darfur. Michael begins.
What is your connection to Darfur? And what is the future of Darfur maybe from today to 2007?
Oh, thank you for this question. My connection to Darfur, I am one of the Darfurians. I am a native Darfurian. I was born in Darfur. And I was born from one of the major tribes in Darfur. Masalit tribes, and it is one of the four major tribes in Darfur, Masalit and Four and Zakawa and Dajo. I said the thing, or I, in according to my an opinion, the future in Darfur right now it looks very cloudy. There's no clear future for Darfur, because Darfur right now, you know, have been murdered. The people of Darfur have been killed. They have been displaced, and all Darfur was destroyed, totally destroyed. People are in the camps, and people outside, scattered outside the country, in Chad and everywhere in the world. I am one of those. I am here in the United States. I am a refugee. Darfur was totally destroyed. There is no future for Darfur unless the international community stand to go to stop this genocide. And then from that point, the future of Darfur will begin, when the people of Darfur will return back from their camps to their own villages, which is totally destroyed, to start to build their villages and to help them to rebuild their villages and to support them and to compensate them and to protect them and offer them full security. And the full security will never be unless those who committed those crimes against the Darfurians to be held and to be charged. Because if they just still release them or still just left them that way, we'll never guarantee that the security and the future for Darfur will be seen in the future.
We heard that in 2004, the United States and other countries decided that they want to put African Union to help Darfur to eradicate the issue about genocide in Darfur. In your opinion, how do you think that's been working? And if it's not working, what do you think has been the issue about the African Union not being able to assist the situation in Darfur?
This is a really very good question, and it is the first time when we learned that the United States and the United Nations, they relied, and even the rest of the world, they relied in African Union as an organization from Africa to take over the issue of Darfur and to try to stop the genocide going on over there. We feel that this is really not enough, because we understand and we know very well that African Union has no history that could give them the credibility to stop the genocide. They don't have logistics. They don't have they don't have well resources. They don't have even capacity, and they are even weak, you know. And in the history of Africa, we witness it. So many conflicts in whole the continent of Africa, especially in Rwanda, that's genocide, and millions of people killed, but African Union doesn't do anything to stop that. In Nigeria, they will never do anything to stop the killings between Christians and Muslims. In the west of Africa also, between Senegal and those people in Mauritania, and there is so many conflict in Congo, in Uganda. You know, in over 3 or 4 decades, Africa witnessed so many wars, but African Union organization will never do anything to stop these wars and these conflicts, and to restore, you know, the problems, and to make sustainable life for the people in Africa. And that's why we will never believe that African Union will do something.
So, Mohammed, what do you think has been the effort of the world, in United States included, the dialogue between the world or United States and that of the Sudanese government? What do you think has been the effort?
It is so many efforts they are supposed to be done to halt any conflict, and especially when the issue was genocide. It was identified as genocide, and this becomes moral, you know, responsibility whenever the issue was recognized and it was proved that it was genocide, they have to act. The United Nations has to act. The United States has to act. All the world has to have to act. And unfortunately, the United States and the United States is a part of United Nations. It is a member of United Nations. And they have always, the United States of America especially, it has so many wonderful initiatives taken in some part of the world to free the people from killing, from being murdered. Even that issue is not even genocide, even never reached to genocide, but they freed those people in Kuwait. The United States freed the people of Kuwait from Iraq in early 1990, and right now they are trying to free the people of Iraq again from their own dictatorship, like Saddam Hussein, and they did that in Yugoslavia. And why they don't want to do it in Darfur, where it is genocide? The United States could play a major role in this, because always the United States takes the initiatives and then the others follow the United States to stop this.
Okay, my name is Karifa Kruma with Michael Saw from Sudan. This is African Fire. We've been talking to Mr. Mohamed Yahya from Sudan as well, who's one of the main tribal leaders of the Darfur region, and he's been talking to us about the genocide in Darfur. Mr. Mohamed Yahya, we want to thank you very much, and we appreciate your effort for assisting us in understanding the issues about the genocide in Darfur on the other side of Africa.
You are very welcome, sir, and this is my pleasure, and thank you for giving me this opportunity to tell my story.
ما لا واحتجب ودع على غضب ما لا واحتجب ودع على غضب ليت هاجري ليت هاجري يشرح السبب.
That was Mohamed Yahya speaking with Africa on Fire's Karifa Kuruma. He was joined by Africa on Fire contributor Michael Chowell. We now turn to Michael and Karifa for further discussion of two issues that Mr. Yahya raised, particularly what is the role of the international community, including the United Nations and the U.S. Karifa begins by tackling Mr. Yahya's assertion that the African Union is not up to the task of stopping the crisis in Darfur.
Let's talk a little bit about the role of the African Union. We know the African Union is very new. We also know that it will be a little bit kind of maybe unfair to criticize that particular entity so soon because they're new. And I feel maybe we should give African Union a little bit of more time to be able to work out the details of how to help Africa in times of war. And I think if we miss that point, maybe we're a little bit prematurely saying African Union is not doing its job. We've heard of lack of training, we've heard of lack of equipment, we've heard of several things. And I think we need to give them a little bit more time and more chance to see how African Union would develop. A lot of other countries will say, Why is Africa not doing enough for Africa? Why do they have to use international forces to go to Africa and fight for Africa when Africa itself can fight its own wars? And if we say that, I think if we can have the equipment and we can have the training, I think Africa should be able to fight its own wars. And I'm hoping as time goes on, Africa will be trained enough to be able to fight wars in Africa rather than asking for international help.
I don't think African can do their job sometime, but they need help. They need money so that they can buy gifts, like they can go to Darfur or Flint, so, but they don't have those. That's why it's better to support them by United Nations. But United Nations is, they've been there like so many long time. They cannot do anything. So they need to provide African Union, like, money they need, gift they need, like friends, so that they can find those guys in Darfur. Those guys who destroy village banning and rap and everything in Darfur. So I think I'm going to, with my colleague, that African Union need to be aggressive in that area. They need to help African Africans in Darfur. They need to help them. They need to stop genocide, because the world is watching them. World don't care. You need to pick your home before you go to another home. You cannot help another family if you don't help your family first. So I think the best thing is to start is African Union to make a better job before the NATO can go or United Nations. The UN involvement, it need to be go with a peacekeeping with the guns, and they need to be they can shoot, they're allowed to shoot, so that they can back up the militia and the militant from Darfur or anywhere around the world. For example, you said about the Rwanda that was offending in 1994. I was in Kenya, and I had one of the teachers from Rwanda was my teacher. He ran away from genocide. And so the genocide was allowed by United Nations about 115 days. They did not refund it. So the and that's why I say United Nations, it's okay, but it does not do the job on the right time. So I agree with people say that United Nations, it can come, but you know, they don't do job right away. So we need more changes from United Nations, so that we need more rule. We encourage that to allow troops to shoot. You know, like peacekeeping, they need like 20,000 troops. They need to be sent to Sudan. But if they are not going to shoot, there will be no peace this year. But if they are going to shoot, I think they need to deploy them in the bushes. In every 50 people, they need to be put in everywhere, in every corner that there's a danger. So that the ginger weed on the camel and the horses will not attack the refugees from the Western Darfur.
I want to emphasize that most of the information we get, even from United Nations compared to African Union, is that the folks are not trained enough. We've heard that over and over in some cases. And we've also heard that United Nations sometimes, countries that are donating countries have never really met up to their funding. So sometimes the training that is coming is not enough for the folks that are supposed to be on the ground. We also have to be careful, because United Nations is not a war machine. They are there to make peace between two factions. So therefore, their role really is to make sure that there's no war happening in the country where they are at. They are really not supposed to take sides from one area to another. They're just there to maintain peace between two countries. So in most cases, I want to say I'm from Sierra Leone, West Africa, and in my experience, what United Nations has done for us has been wonderful. They've done a very good job, and up to now, as I speak, they're there and without them Sierra Leone will have erupt into war. So I have to say, some have some criticism about United Nations, which we know that we've sometimes we've been blaming on funding and lack of training, but we also know that if they get the equipment and training that they need, they can be a very big asset to anywhere there's war.
This last weekend, Portland and the globe witnessed a growing movement pleading with United Nations and the United States to do more to stop genocide in Darfur. Africa on Fire's Kirsten Flagg spoke with some of the hundreds who turned out for a Portland Save Darfur concert and rally, timed to coincide with a larger march in Washington, D.C.
March 4th, Portland's own marching band opened up Amnesty International USA's benefit concert for their Darfur campaign. I asked those in the crowd, both pop music fans and human rights activists, just one question. What should the international community do right now to stop the genocide in Darfur?
My name is Carlos, and I'm a wildland firefighter. I think shows like this benefit show, are a good start just to get people like aware of it, because before this came about, I wasn't really aware of it.
Amy Augustine from Silver Spring, Maryland. I'm the Stop Violence Against Women campaign coordinator for Amnesty International. I think the one thing we can do right now is encourage Congress to increase funding for the African Union peace forces that are already there.
My name is Cedric Walker, and I'm a business owner. I think that what they need to do is they need to get all the politics out of it and just start thinking about human beings and use whatever resources they have at their disposal to go and start saving human lives.
Mingling among Collective Soul and Incubus fans, Amnesty collected over 800 signatures on their petition to the Sudanese government and UN Saturday night. The momentum continued throughout the weekend. At a rally at Pioneer Square on Sunday, over 2,000 signed postcards calling on President Bush to support a stronger multinational peacekeeping force. The rally was organized by American Jewish World Service, among other groups, and nearly filled all of Pioneer Square.
My name is Rami Yosef. I'm from Rwanda, and I'm here in Poland for 1 year. I'm taking English courses at Lewiston and Clark College. I think as an African, I can say that they should stop watching, but taking action. I think this is really something like I would like to say, because even though we're still crying and crying never again and never again without taking an action, it will never end. So just stop watching or organizing meeting. Just take an action and stop the genocide.
My name is Samuel Pere Diller. I'm from the Sudan, the southern Sudan in particular. And I've been in Portland area for over 9 years. And I do work for Intel Corporation as an electrical engineer. Basically, what we need to do right now is to have the peacekeeping troops sent to Darfur without any delay. If we don't do any peacekeeping troops there, then our government is continue to delay, and they're going to lie, and they're going to maim the people and continue to brutalize the people in Darfur. And we need to have this UN peacekeeping troops done there as soon as possible.
I'm Kirsten Flagg reporting for Africa on Fire.
Local resident Samuel Dila, the last man Kirsten spoke with, also works for an organization called Make Sudan Better Foundation, which supports schools, orphanages, and agricultural projects in his home country. You can contact him at 503-848-3880. Earlier in the program, we listened to Jewish human rights activist Ruth Messenger speaking about ongoing genocide in Darfur. In Rwanda, as early as the 1920s, Belgian colonists began elevating the Hutu ethnic group, measuring the heads and noses of both Hutu and Tutsis for alleged superiority. This attempt to separate groups is similar to what occurred in Germany before the Nazi Holocaust there. This continued divide-and-conquer regime in Rwanda eventually led to nearly a million Tutsi deaths in 1994. In the Central African country of the Democratic Republic of Congo, 4 million people have died in a recent 6-year ethnic war, which has received little media attention. The DRC is a huge country, one-fourth the size of the United States, and rich in natural resources. We're joined now by our guest co-host for tonight, Elise Akombele. Elise was born in the DRC and lived there for 28 years before she fled her country's war. She was assisted out of the Democratic Republic of Congo by the United Nations and lived as a refugee in Senegal for 8 years before resettling in Portland in 1997. Elise, what do people need to understand about the Democratic Republic of Congo? Mm-hmm.
Congo is a big country with many resources, infrastructure, are destroyed since ethnic war, and a lot of genocide are committed over there. But what I ask now, it's time now to stop to do bad things, and everybody over there supposed to focus on building our country that can benefit people inside and outside.
Elise, can you give us a little bit of a snapshot of what happened to you during the war and how you were assisted out of the DRC?
I was assisted by the UN over there, and the UN moved us from DRC to the neighbor country. And after, it was in Tanzania, and after the Tanzania, I moved to Senegal. And after Senegal, I stay 8 years over there, and I resettle in U.S. in Portugal, in Portland.
And how has it been resettling in Portland? What kind of difficulties have you had?
In Portland, I did not get many difficulties, and I think I try to afford and struggle the life here, and it was nice for me. I struggle like everybody, mm-hmm. and yeah.
Okay. A European Union Reserve Force is now being deployed to the Democratic Republic of Congo. Endorsed by the United Nations, the deployment is to provide stability for July elections, the first DRC election in nearly 40 years. The Congolese elections are supported by the largest and most expensive electoral assistance operation the United Nations has ever undertaken. It is hoped the process will cement the country's transition from years of war. Thank you, Elise Akombele, our guest co-host for this evening. Guests for tonight's show are Ruth Messenger, Mohamed Yahya, Karifa Karoma, and Michael Chow. Appreciations to Katie J. Scott and the local Genocide Awareness Week volunteers, as well as Amnesty International and Gareth Jenkins. Join us here at Africa on Fire every first Thursday from 6 to 7 p.m. Email us at africaonfire@yahoo.com. Producers for tonight's program are Michael Chowell, Judy Feistel, Kirsten Flagg, and Karifa Karoma. Lead producer is Rob Manning. Engineer is Kirk Vandeveer. Theme song was produced impromptu at KBOO Studios by Vancouver's African Gospel A Cappella. Elder consultants are Grace Kuto and Bosco Conte. For Africa on Fire, I'm host and founder Marianne Fry. Go connect to the great continent of light. Africa is on fire.
Africa is on fire. Africa, Africa is on fire. Africa, Africa is on fire. Africa is on fire. Africa, Africa, yeah, is on fire. Africa, Africa is on fire. Africa, Africa is on fire. Africa is on fire. Africa.
Africa, 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 is on Africa is on fire. Africa, Africa, yeah, is on fire. Africa, Africa is on fire.
Yes, 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 another wonderful, wonderful show. So glad we got that on here. Africa on Fire is over. Good time show is coming up. It's 7 o'clock. Welcome to KBOO again.
Vision.